Any discussion to the motion to approve the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails, and the minutes for March 6, 2024 are approved. The first bill on the agenda is House File 4569 from Chair Howard. Chair Howard, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. Chair Howard moves that the House Files 4569 be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Chair Howard, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Igbaje. Members, as we've talked a lot in this committee, we know that Minnesota is facing a housing crunch, a housing crisis. More than 600,000 Minnesotans are struggling to afford their homes, and all across the state we have housing shortages and the needs are significant. We in the legislature have taken bold steps this last year and beyond to provide more resources to help build more units, and need to take that all hands on deck if we're going to meet this moment into the future. But what we cannot do is have public dollars go to exploiting workers that are building the homes that Minnesotans so desperately need. And unfortunately, a report by the North Star Policy Action Committee has detailed that practice is happening. In particular, the report details how funding through LIHTC projects and TIF financing has been used in ways that have really done exploitive things for workers. And I really hope folks will read the report or the one pager attached to it, because it's really alarming and should be a call to action for the legislature that we need to take action. And that's what House File 4569 seeks to do in a couple of ways. First, the bill would ensure that prevailing wage is applied to LIHTC projects of 10 units and above. Currently, nearly all or most of funding through MHFA projects are subject to prevailing wage, but currently LIHTC is not. And so this would apply that to LIHTC, but provide that flexibility so that it would apply 10 units and above. Secondly, we would look at ways to ensure more transparency. You know, sunshine can be the best disinfectant. We would ensure that developers have to provide a list of the contractors and subcontractors they're working with on projects, those subcontractors have a history of poor labor practices, wage theft, and a list of other conditions. Third, we have accountability measures in this bill. So that if a developer continues to engage in these types of practices, you know, they will lose out on the ability to secure those public resources in the future. And all put together, what we see here is a bill that would help us ensure that when we're building homes that are affordable, we're doing so with respect and dignity for the workers that are building them. And with that, I'll turn it to my testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Howard. We have a couple testifiers on the list. The first person is Jake Schwitzer. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Thank you, Chair. My name is Jake Schwitzer, and I am the Executive Director of North Star Policy Action. We're a think tank that promotes data-driven solutions to help working Minnesotans thrive. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 4569. Minnesota faces a severe housing crisis caused by a shortage of affordable homes, and the problem is getting worse. The supply of low-cost rental housing in Minnesota has actually decreased by a quarter over the last decade. More than 10% of Minnesotans are cost-burdened, which means they spend more than 30% of their household income on housing. Now, thankfully, as Representative Howard said, this legislature has stepped up and last session provided record investments to address housing affordability. Most sources of public financing for affordable housing do already have strong labor standards, which is critically important because wage theft and exploitation are persistent problems in the multifamily housing construction industry. Unfortunately, two of the largest sources of public financing for affordable housing, low-income housing tax credits, or LIHTC, and tax increment financing, or TIF, are lacking in important safeguards for workers. In November, North Star Policy Action released our report called Subsidizing Abuse. This report named contractors that have been charged with or face allegations of exploitation according to interviews with workers and industry experts. We identified housing developments that have received funding from LIHTC and TIF and are still employing the problem contractors that we named. We found that, since 2016, workers on 25 projects that received approximately $31 million in LIHTC funding were at risk of exploitation by problem contractors. And since 2018, workers on 14 projects that received approximately $53 million in TIF subsidies were also at risk. In total, over $84 million in taxpayer subsidies have gone to projects employing contractors with proven or alleged labor violations. Now, when we say things like labor violations, worker exploitation, wage theft, it can sound very general, a lot of legalese. This is dehumanizing the actual abuse of workers that is so common in this industry. In our report, we're talking about contractors who have refused to pay their workers' wages and offered them illegal drugs instead, or used child labor, or threatened to fire a woman for reporting sexual assault on the job, or covering up serious workplace injuries. If you're a contractor who's guilty of abuses like these, you shouldn't be working on publicly subsidized projects. It's as simple as that. And developers need to be held responsible for the contractors that they hire. That's why this bill, HF 4569, is so important. Expanding prevailing wage requirements to LIHTC projects will protect workers on those job sites and across the industry from depressed wages. Increasing transparency of who's actually working on these projects will make it harder for bad actors to avoid accountability through layers of subcontractors. And increasing developer accountability will mean project owners can't shirk responsibility for abuses on their projects, all while collecting the profits. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list is Lucas Franco. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Vice Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lucas Franco. I'm here on behalf of Leuna, Minnesota and North Dakota, a union of more than 14,000 proud men and women who build our state's critical infrastructure. I'm here to speak in favor of HF 4569. As we've heard, there continues to be a widespread shortage of affordable housing. More than 10% of Minnesotans are cost burdened, and even many of our members who generally earn good family-sustaining wages continue to have challenges renting or buying a home. Thankfully, this body and many other units of government have really stepped up to provide critical financial assistance to meet our housing needs. Yet, as Jake Schweitzer just discussed and the North Star Policy Action Report revealed, too many of these public dollars are channeled to problem contractors that build new housing on the backs of vulnerable workers. This includes one contractor that deprived workers of more than $126,000 in wages, misclassified workers, and submitted misleading information during the course of an investigation. And yet this contractor, like many others, were back working on publicly subsidized projects. We need to address our housing shortages, but we cannot allow public dollars to fund worker exploitation. This bill will prevent exploitation by implementing robust labor standards on grant and tax incentive programs. And I want to just briefly highlight a few key provisions of this bill. First, the bill expands prevailing wage coverage on LIHTC projects. As we have seen for over 100 years, or close to 100 years, prevailing wage policies protect construction workers from wage theft and exploitation and ensure that responsible local contractors are not put out of business by unfair competition. Prevailing wage policies achieve these goals with at most a minimal impact on housing costs. A 2021 peer-reviewed study in the International Journal of Employment Relations disputes the 15% cost impact number that's often cited by opponents of prevailing wage and instead found modest impacts on prevailing wage on overall project cost in the affordable housing market. And the authors conclude that the modest impacts were likely explained by the widespread prevalence of, quote, illegal and undesirable practices, unquote, such as widespread misclassification found in the housing industry more generally. Second, this bill will prevent the use of problem contractors on all types of MHFA-funded projects by applying the Minnesota's well-proven and effective responsible contractor law into the space of public financing. And third, this bill closes the developer accountability gap that we so consistently see in our industry. Too often, developers claim that they have no responsibility for what happens on their projects. They generally pass the buck down to their generals or lower-tier subs. This lack of accountability allows these low-road practices to fester, and this bill will break that cycle. In summary, this bill will break the pattern of problem contractors working on publicly subsidized projects and prevent worker exploitation by guaranteeing family-sustaining wages, by extending Minnesota's responsible contractor law, and by holding developers accountable that repeatedly use irresponsible contractors on their projects. Thank you for your time and consideration of this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. The last testifier on the list signed up is John Bosch. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Beshe. I'm with the Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some comments on HF 4569. ABC is a trade association that is made up of 340 commercial and industrial contractors and their 20,000-plus employees. These men and women are part of the 75% of the construction industry in Minnesota that choose to be merit shop craft professionals. ABC promotes free enterprise and fair and open competition in the construction industry in which anyone can succeed based on merit. We oppose violence, coercion, intimidation, and the denial of the rights of both employees, management, and we believe that work opportunities should be made available to all people regardless of labor affiliation. ABC is opposed to the requirement in this bill that would require the prevailing wage to be paid on multifamily housing projects with 10 units or more. These projects are funded with otherwise private dollars, and we are concerned that such a mandate will limit competition, increase the cost of construction, and result in overall higher project costs. There are numerous studies out there that show that prevailing wage does increase the cost of construction, but more importantly than any study is the experience of our local Minnesota ABC contractors who have often reported increased bid costs due to various prevailing wage mandates, oftentimes with a cost increase of at least 10 to 15%. In fact, just this last fall, we had a local member who had contracted to perform improvements for a school district in southwestern Minnesota. The project was originally bid with prevailing wage requirements, and after seeing the increase in costs due to those requirements, the school district ultimately decided to rebid the project at market rate. We're concerned that these increased project costs will be passed on and that this will have the adverse impact of driving up the cost of multifamily housing, making affordable housing more expensive for those who need it most. In conclusion, while we support efforts to enforce current wage theft prevention laws and ensure that workers get paid, we don't believe that the prevailing wage mandate will aid in this effort. Rather, we are concerned that the unintended consequences of such a mandate will result in fewer contractors building low-income housing, opting instead to build market-rate multifamily housing units where they can pay the local market-based wage. Instead of enacting policies that make it more difficult for high-quality local contractors to compete, we urge the state to enact policies that promote fair and open competition in the construction industry. We respectfully request a no vote on the bill or that it be amended to remove the prevailing wage mandate. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, John Beshe. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, I'll open for member discussion. Yes, Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Abaje. Chair Howard. I just wanted to touch on wage theft, and I know last session Representative Feist had passed a bill, and so I'm just wondering if you feel like you are taking this stance because that bill didn't do enough, or how those bills kind of interact with each other.
Chair Howard.
Chair Igbaje, Representative Myers. This bill is specifically targeted some of the issues that were sort of unearthed with the report that was mentioned, particular to housing practice. So it's narrow in focus in terms of what we see is happening in particular with projects funded through these LIHTC dollars, and in sort of assessing how those projects are funded, a solution that's sort of narrowly tailored to those issues.
Representative Myers?
Yep, and just to follow up, so is it you're saying that previous legislation that passed didn't cover this and that's why you're doing it?
Chair Howard?
Chair Igbaje, Representative Myers, I'm not versed in the details of Representative Feist's bill, but know that these solutions are tailored to the practices that were going on and are warranted.
Representative Myers, any other further questions? Representative Dotson.
Thank you, Chair Abaje, and Chair Howard. Question I've got is, what does it look like as far as transparency of this so there's some accountability as we manage through this program?
Chair Howard?
Yeah, thank you. Good question, Representative Dotson. So the way we look at transparency in the bill is through disclosures. And so we make sure that developers, if they're going to be using a subcontractor that has sort of past issues with either a conviction, a court judgment, an agency determination, a legal sentiment, ongoing criminal and civil investigations, a number of things, we require that the developer report that publicly. And we think that will have an impact. You know, if a developer knows that they have to sort of, the contractor they're pursuing has these violations and know they're going to have to sort of say this is who we're using, we think that will discourage, hopefully, using some of these bad actors that sort of have a history of poor practices.
Representative Dothak.
Thank you, Chair. I guess just a follow-up question. Any potential liability that would fall upon any of the players involved with this as well?
Chair Howard.
Chair Gbadji, Representative Dotson, could you say more? I'm not sure I quite understand.
Liability, any passing of liability that may go on to this as we move forward with this, since this is managed to present in this manner?
Chair Howard.
Does that make sense?
So are you saying who has the liability if a subcontractor versus a contractor versus a, yeah. This bill doesn't really touch on those aspects, so I assume existing law would be in place in terms of who has liability for X, Y, and Z. Although I would say that if we passed this law, I think we would see fewer subcontractors and folks that have a bad track record on a whole number of host of issues being utilized. So I think you'd see better construction, fair construction, and workers being treated more fairly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dossas. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm looking at the bill, and I think the last testifier brought up something that I had been thinking about, and that is that, first of all, we don't want exploitation, and we don't want to have bad actors in the situation. But I'm wondering if there's any analysis on whether or not this actually will increase costs either marginally or more than that. Has there been any analysis on how that may be impacted by utilizing prevailing wage and other things throughout the system?
Chair Howard?
Chair Gbadji, Representative Petersburg, we heard some sort of different stories about, and I think there's a volume of reports about how much and the impact of prevailing wage to cost. I think one thing I'd note is if we're comparing prevailing wage to sort of practices that are, you know, unfair to workers, I'm not sure that that's, you know, I'm sort of not comfortable with that floor where we're not treating workers well with dignity and respect. And so I guess from my perspective is I don't think we should sort of set ourselves up for a sort of false choice about whether we can have, you know, treat workers, pay workers a fair wage, et cetera, while, you know, contemplating sort of, well, is this going to cost too much? I think we can do both at the same time. And I think the evidence is that we're not seeing costs, you know, really drive up with prevailing wage. And I would mention that already prevailing wage applies to, you know, public funded projects at MHFA. And MHFA administers these LIHTC funds. And so in some sense, I think, as I've talked to folks, people are surprised it's not already included. And again, we have included that 10-unit piece to sort of right size as well.
Representative Peters, please.
Thank you. And no, I agree with you. I'm not saying we should think about the floor as being there. I'm just being realistic in saying that if contractors have been doing these practices, it's sometimes in order to underbid, et cetera, which then has a tendency that the overall cost could go up. And I'm just saying realistically, when we look into the future and these programs are, if there is a percentage increase that we would now have to bake in order to do what is right, basically. So I'm not talking about that we need to use that as a floor or use that any reason why we shouldn't do this. I'm just realistically saying, you know, when we do things that we are in this particular situation looking for, we have to understand that there's a little cost that has been built into the budget, and we have to just be realistic about that. That's all I was referring to. Thank you.
Representative Johnson, anyone else? So I think it's your turn.
Chair Bajaj, Chair Howard, I like the overall like the concept of this bill, because we do not want wage theft whatsoever. But I do have some concerns on it. On in section subdivision 5, lines 20 or 3.25 to 3.26, it talks about the recipient being responsible for the correction. I'm just wondering, is that the recipient of the grant from MFHA, or is that the recipients from the funds for that that was given to a, say, the contractor to pay his employees?
Chair
Howard? Or a subcontract that was given to pay his employees?
Chair Igbaje, I might ask a nonpartisan, but my I'll just ask nonpartisan if they would.
Mr. Pope.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I believe the reference here is to the recipient of the MHFA funds, whatever entity applied for and received the grant or loan.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Badger, Representative Howard. So that would be the possibly the developer. Now, with the developer who hired a contractor, or a general contractor who hired contractors, who may have hired subcontractors, that the developer has no clue who they were, but the developer is at fault. And he's the one that's getting charged. Even though he paid for it, now he has to pay again. He did good things. He did things in good faith, and somebody else down the line violated that faith. Why is it we're going after the developer instead of the person that, or the contractor or subcontractor that actually violated it?
Chair Howard.
Chair Igbaje, Lee Johnson, you know, the phrase that comes to mind is the buck stops here. You know, when you're the entity in charge of this development, there comes with it some accountability, some responsibility. And what we've seen is that there's a handful of developers that continue to engage in the same practices. The same practices keep coming up. And sometimes that is sort of what we hear from, I think, from the developers. Well, I didn't know this was going on. I think it's appropriate to put more accountability on the developer who is ultimately responsible for the type of housing that they're building and the kind of folks that they're employing to use to do the work.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Igbaje, Representative Howard. I somewhat understand that, but a lot of times these developers are putting in a lot of their own money as well. They usually have to have matching funds. They do not want... Most of them, the vast majority, want things done properly. I guess if we have, if there's developers having a common practice of that, maybe there should be a list put together that they're not eligible for the funds to begin with. In greater Minnesota, we have a huge problem, a lack of housing, especially workforce housing. If you remember last year, former representative, name slipped my mind now, but better known as Coach.
Fabian
was here and talking about the problems they were having up in Roseau because of prevailing wage. Because of prevailing wage, it brought the cost to the point where it cost more to build the facility than actually the property was worth when it was done. So they couldn't do it. We had to change some statutes in the grants to go from, I believe we went from 75-25% match, or 25% grant, 75% match, to a 50-50, so they could actually build the housing they needed for the workforce housing in up in Roseau. I have concern that this is going to even make the situation worse. We are over 100,000 units short in this state. One of the testifiers talked about how that's so little difference happening between the cost and the prevailing wage. That may be true in the metro area, but in greater Minnesota, it's a huge difference. That's where that 11-12% difference in cost comes up. It makes a difference whether something is buildable and viable or can't be done. So I do have concerns with that part of it. The prevailing wage in the metro is totally different in when you get out to greater Minnesota. Unfortunately, a lot of our contractors, local contractors, don't fill out the form. How do we get them to do that? So we actually get a true account of what the prevailing wage in those communities are. So that's an issue we have to deal with. And then a lot of these projects, whether they're larger projects, 10 units or more, in greater Minnesota, there's not that many companies that can actually build them. So that, and now the ones that can, they're going to be locked out. They could be locked out just because of the prevailing wage issue and what they pay their employees to begin with and what things going on. And when you get to the point where the property is more than what it is worth, less than what it costs to build, it's not going to happen. So like I say, I do have concerns on this, especially when it's going after the person acting in good faith and not the actual culprit that's going to be responsible for the wage theft. I do have problems. I think this bill needs to move on to get dealt with, but I hope you understand the issues that our side of the aisle have on this, and hopefully we can work it out.
Thank you, Lee Johnson. Any other comments from members? Not seeing any. Any final remarks, Chair Howard?
Chair Gbaje, I would say thanks for the comments, Lee Johnson. Some of the economics that are happening, particular related to housing development in greater Minnesota, require specific solutions. I believe that we can and should do something like this, but that doesn't, we can and should be looking at ways to help cities, you know, pay for infrastructure costs and look at some of the other reasons why. I think there are other, there are underlying economic reasons why some of that development is hard and sort of why things aren't penciling out, and that requires our attention. But again, I think this bill, and I appreciate some of the comments about the intent, happy to continue to kind of work towards resolution. And, you know, I hope we can have agreement essentially that public dollars should never fund worker exploitation. Again, that's what this bill seeks to do. And I'd appreciate the support of the committee.
Chair Howard renews the motion that House File 4569 be re-referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All in favor say aye. Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
House File 4569 is referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All right. Second bill on the agenda, also Chair Howard. Chair Howard, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Chair Gbaje, I will move my bill.
Chair Howard moves that House File 4271 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Chair Howard, to your bill.
And I think I do have...
Do you have an amendment?
We have an amendment. Not in the packet.
Don't have one with me. We don't.
We prepared one. This is something we could. There's a technical piece that we could address on the floor.
Okay.
But happy to proceed.
Okay. We'll move forward with the bill as is.
So House File 4271 is a very technical bill, but it's also a very important bill related to making sure that we maximize our ability to provide and preserve public housing all across the state. We've talked about this issue and deployed more resources in recent years to help build and preserve our public housing that's owned and operated all across the state. And our public housing authorities do amazing work to try to maximize everything they can do to provide this housing, address community and local needs. One of the things that they will seek to do is maximize the federal resources they receive, and that has often or will require them to incorporate themselves in a slightly different manner. And what we've run into is an issue where they're forced to basically choose. Should we reorient and pursue these federal funds and maximize the federal dollars we can get? But if we do that, are we putting at risk our ability to access POP funds or public housing funds through general obligation bonding dollars? because we have a situation where Minnesota management and budget has raised concerns about the validity or the public ownership of these entities. And what this bill seeks to do is clarify that when a housing authority recreates itself, basically a carbon copy of itself, they truly are a public entity, and they operate in every which way that the original entity would do so. And, you know, I sort of liken it to if it looks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And if these public housing authorities act like a public housing authority or organized as such, then they are one. And so that's what this bill seeks to clarify so that we can maximize our public housing authorities across the state to be able to seek and utilize resources to provide public housing all across the state.
Thank you, Chair Howard. There's a couple testifiers on the list. First is Assistant Commissioner Jen Hasmer. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon to members of the committee. For the record, I am Jennifer Hasmer, Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for the opportunity to make a brief comment on House File 4271. Chair Howard has heard me speak to this bill recently, and we appreciate the recent conversations we've been able to have with advocates. This is an issue that MMB has been engaged on for many years with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the Minnesota chapter of the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. We look forward to continued discussions about the technical aspects of this bill and any amendment. Unfortunately, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development did not design the Rental Assistance Demonstration, or RAD, program with Minnesota's constitution in mind. There are barriers to making all options under RAD work for public housing authorities that have received state bonds in the past and that may seek them again in the future. The Constitution requires that state bonds can only be appropriated for projects owned by state agencies or political subdivisions of the state. MMB's ongoing interest in this conversation will be protecting the validity of the state's bonds and ensuring that the constitutional public ownership requirement continues to be met. We may not be able to find a solution for all cases of RAD, but we have been exploring options that appear to be available under current law, and we look forward to continuing these discussions about what may be possible with the stakeholders. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Melissa Taphorn. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Melissa Taphorn. I'm the legislative chair of Minnesota chapter of NARO, our National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, and the executive director of the Washington County CDA, or Community Development Agency. Chair Bage and Lee Johnson, committee members, thank you for your consideration of House File 4271. You've heard repeatedly from us about the shortfall of federal funds, and you have repeatedly responded with general obligation bonds for public housing rehab. Thank you very, very much. We really appreciate that. We know that's not a never-ending supply of money, however, you know. So we've continued to look for other means to not only address that capital backlog, as well as keep up with the maintenance of our public housing. HUD has even provided us with some paths to do that. That's called repositioning. RAD is one of those paths. But these paths allow housing authorities to bring in other federal funds as well as borrow as needed against the properties to address our capital needs. A couple of these paths require the housing authority to create a separate entity while still in the housing authority's control. And that's where we have a disagreement and issue. However, we're unable to do that if we have a POP loan and intend to apply for one because the new entity is not considered a public entity according to management or Minnesota Management and Budget. This bill attempts to cure that. It is important to note that it does not expand the number of properties that are eligible for POP funds, nor does it circumvent the public purpose and public ownership eligibility for general obligation bonds. My colleague from Minneapolis will share how this impacts their portfolio, but while you listen to his story, please keep in mind that the vast majority of housing authorities in Minnesota have one public housing building, maybe usually less than 50 units. And they don't have in-house counsel to advise them or negotiate a case-by-case basis with MMB. For my housing authority, we took out a $271,000 POP loan about 10 years ago against our 40-unit public housing building, which is the only public housing units that we have. We'd like to reposition these units to a Housing Choice Voucher platform, which is one of the repositioning paths. Where HUD would pay us, it has the potential to go from $280 a month per unit to $1,020 a unit per month. And that alone would give us $355,000 just in 1 year to reinvest in that property. Right now we have to wait until our POP loan is paid off, which is out until, or not paid off, but expires in 2051. Even if we wanted to pay it off, those restrictions continue before we could reposition. We look forward to working with you to find a clear and transparent process to ensure a long-term solution for our public housing. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Last on the list is Abdi Warsami. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Chair Abaje, my name is Abdi Warsami, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. Thank you, Chair Howard, Chair Abaje, and members of the committee for welcoming me today. I'm here in support of HF4271. My name is Abdi Warsami. I'm the Executive Director of the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. Currently, MPHA maintains nearly 700 deeply affordable family homes across nearly every neighborhood of the city. For years, these homes existed in MPHA's Section 9 public housing program. During that time, they amassed a major capital backlog following decades of federal disinvestment in public housing. To help save these homes in 2020, MPHA converted this portfolio from Section 9 public housing to Section 8 housing choice vouchers. The conversion was guided by HUD and led to the utilization of a wholly controlled nonprofit community housing resources that could receive federal Section 8 funding. Through that conversion and transfer to CHR, MPHA was able to more than double the federal subsidy it received for operating the same homes. However, it is this conversion that MMB has since determined makes these homes now ineligible for POP GO bonds. Despite being the same MPHA residents, served by the same MPHA team members, guided by the same CEO and the Board of Commissioners, MMB has determined this portfolio is ineligible. We know that because at the time of the conversion, two of these 700 plus homes had repairs previously funded by POP GO bonds, and therefore MMB refused to let us convert them. That means we have two family homes receiving less than half the federal subsidy that they could be getting, further worsening our capital backlog because of MMB's decision. In fact, it's because of this POP GO bonding issue that the agency came before this committee last season seeking a POP cash grant to clear this capital backlog. Now, I can appreciate MMB's caution in protecting public bonding dollars. But what gets lost in this conversation is that there are 3,100 people living in these homes with a collective backlog of $33 million in maintenance and repair needs. Of the 3,100 CHR residents, 88% are black, 86% are female head of households, and more than half are children. Well-meaning lawyers and MMB staff might tell you all the technical reasons for why MPHA's wholly controlled nonprofit doesn't perfectly fit MMB's definition of publicly owned. But I'm here to tell you that for every day we spend going back and forth on specific word in state statute, is another day a leaky roof isn't repaired, it's another day an old drafty window isn't replaced, and it's another day we risk decades-old electrical or plumbing systems failing because we cannot access PAP GO bonds for these homes. I urge members of this committee to support aligning federal best practices with existing state programs and ensure that the most economically vulnerable families in Minneapolis and around our state are invested in the way the legislature intended when it passed more than $40 million in PAP GO bonds last season. Thank you again for the opportunity, and thank you for your support.
Thank you for your testimony. Any members of the public wishing to testify? Not seeing any, I'll go to member discussion. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got to make sure I don't knock that on the floor. To the author, question for you. How many total single-family houses can these corporations own at one time?
Chair Howard.
Chair Igbaja, I might phone a friend with some of our NARO folks.
Thank you. Just state your name and then answer the question.
Melissa Taphorn and Madam Chair and Representative Nash. Each housing authority, you would create one of these corporations or companies per project. What HUD requires is that it be a single asset entity. So if you had a collection of scattered sites, the single family homes, you would group those in however many number of units that you would have. Generally, most of the public housing in Minnesota is in an apartment building, so it would be 20 to however many, 200 units each public housing building would have.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just to drill down, I mean, we heard Bill not long ago that a corporation may not own more than 10. Does it create problems for you with this bill and doing that? Because if you're going to group single families in an area, let's say there's a neighborhood and some public housing authority might own 10, 12, 15, are they going to be subject to the same forced divestment as other corporations?
Before I go to Chair Howard, did you want me to take that or do you want to take that?
Chair Igbaje, I'll just say I do not have the same concerns. These are public, for our public housing, I think there's a giant gulf between how we think about a public housing operator and a hedge fund out on the East Coast. So,
Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think we heard the other day, and then I'll be done, that taking these single family homes off the potential market to buy is the insidious problem that's trying to be solved, and a public corporation owning them does deny someone the opportunity to themselves gain property rights through the ownership of a single-family home. So I would disagree with you, Mr. Chair, that if that problem is indeed insidious, then this is the same level that would be created. Thank you.
Any other comments? All right. Well, before we close out, I mean, I think this is an interesting bill for supporting public housing. We want to be able to ensure, since the federal government has not invested in public housing, that we have opportunities for our public housing providers to be able to do so. And similarly, though we're not supposed to talk about other bills at this time, I would say that that other bill has a number of exemptions under which public housing authorities would qualify. Chair Howard, any final remarks?
I think Chair Igbaje and for folks that testified in the discussion, I really appreciate it. This is an important bill. It's an important issue we need to resolve this year. I appreciate MMB testifying and their continued engagement. I think there's a number of ways to get there, but we need to get there. It's long past time, and that's why this it's important that this bill continues to move forward.
And Chair Howard, I understand we will be changing the motion for this bill.
Yes, Madam Chair. I would prefer that we lay this bill over today and take up this really technical amendment tomorrow, and we can send it out tomorrow.
All right. That sounds like a good plan. So this bill will be laid over, and House File 4271 is laid over on the table. Any other announcements, Chair Howard? All right. Members, seeing no other comments, we are adjourned.